Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another day, therefore it's another episode. I hope you're all doing well. Today's going to brighten up your day. This is an absolutely wonderful episode. Not because of my lispy Essex twang, but because of today's guest. And that guest is David Gray. This is a cracker, this one. You're in for a real treat. David was an absolute joy to talk to. Chose some incredible records, and we had a real laugh. And you're about to hear that, obviously. Before that, just a few thank yous. So a thank you to Scribius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. A big thank you to 76 for producing this podcast. Thank you to you lot for continuing to support this podcast. You've literally made, we talk about lockdown at the beginning of so many of these episodes with the guests, and the thing that has 100% kept my brain where it needs to be and has kept me balanced and excited about creativity and ideas and people and conversation is doing this podcast. And I wouldn't be doing that if it wasn't for the encouragement that I get through you lot, whether it's messages on the socials or likes and shares and retweets, or just seeing that, you know, the amount of listens that I'm getting, you know, it's growing nicely. And so it's all thanks to you lot. So thank you very much. Also, if this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track, welcome. You've chose a good one to start with. When you finish listening to my chat with David, go and have a look in the archives, because there's some lovely chats to be had. There's probably about 270. They're all for free, so go and get stuck in. You know, why not go and listen to me talk to Maxine Peake or the Foo Fighters or Motley Crue or Fatboy Slim? There's so many now, and for some reason when I rattle off them, I always rattle off the same ones. Chuck D from Public Enemy, that's a great chat. The actress Jo Hartley has definitely been a listener favourite. I can't recommend that one enough. And go and have a look, because, you know, if you like your musicians, there's hundreds. And, you know, I've had chats with producers such as Butch Vig, which is a great episode. Chats with comedians such as James Acaster, Ed Gamble, Maisie Adam. Oh, there's loads. Go and have a rummage in that archive and have a little listen. And drop us a message. Let us know what you think. Well, I guess I'm kind of done with all the pre-show ramble. So should we get on to the good stuff now? And it's really weird. You can't say ramble now without feeling like you're ripping off Buxton. But I'm not. I'm not. It's just what I'm doing when I'm wittering on. Anyway, let's get on with today's episode. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with the wonderful David Gray. Right, I've got to take a quick break in this podcast because I've got some super exciting news. Off the Beaten Track podcast is proud to go into partnership with the Cacao Bar from Hotel Chocolat. That's right. The Cacao Bar is not a chocolate bar. It's all the best bits of a chocolate bar put into a really exciting new alcoholic range. That's right. Gin, vodka, and a beautiful range of cream liqueurs. So One of the big bonuses of this partnership is obviously I'm super thrilled to have Hotel Chocolat working with us, but they sent me a great big box of this stuff. And I'm telling you, it's amazing. Go and check it out, www.hotelchocolat.com or over on the socials at Hotel Chocolat. But yeah, in the coming months, there's going to be opportunities for you to get involved with competitions with us, to win bottles of stuff. There's loads of exciting things coming soon, and I can't be more happy to say that this podcast is in partnership with the Cacao Bar from Hotel Chocolat. All right, let's get back to the podcast.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Right, we are recording. Joining me today via the means of Zoom, David Gray. Hello.
Hello there.
How you doing?
I'm not too bad, yeah. You know, I'm getting older, so there are a few bits falling off. But apart from the general maintenance and sort of MOT type stuff that I'm having to do, I'm feeling all right. I've got the joys of spring, I think, starting to pulse through the brain cells and the body, seeing the sun and just being outside. So, yeah, I'm feeling not bad today.
Good, good, good. Do you think it's a thing like, I'm 48 on Wednesday, and I've realised that any kind of imperfections and like ailments now are at the forefront of any conversation I have. So, how you been? Yeah, not bad. I mean, I've had a bit of a, like, my knee's been giving me a bit of shit, but, you know, I'll live.
Oh, God, yeah. I'm on last warning because I keep going on. I've had a succession of back problems. Maybe it's like middle age and the sort of, you know, the sort of stress of this middle zone. Maybe that's what it's really about.
Sure.
Everything coming home to roost. But obviously, it's a bit of wear and tear as well. And I've been doing what I've been doing for the last 30 years. And it's obviously going to have a sort of an effect on my body. They don't put a flight case around you and they ship you around the world. So,
that's right.
You know, it is, yeah, but the moaning and groaning, oh, my God, you know, I'm not really aware of it. It's become, I'm such a constant, I've had so many constant back problems. They won't take any more now. I'm getting gypped from everybody.
I mean, well, I guess sort of the physical side of you aside, David, before we start with the playlist, just looking back over the last sort of over a year now, just wondering how you found it as both David Gray, family man, human being, and David Gray, creative.
Well, the family man first. It's been a real blessing to be able to spend this time. And, you know, and I've got many blessings to count. You know, none of us have had COVID or close family members have had COVID in an extreme way. We've had various, you know, friends and family members. My daughter's had it, blah blah blah. And also the kids are that little bit older, so if we'd have had two, you know, little tearaways running around the place, it would have been a different story, I think. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's like I've got some room, I've got my studio, but I've really not done that much creative stuff. I mean, I have. But I chip away. But I've tried to, and I'm not very good at this, so I'm a beginner in terms of trying to give some space to other things rather than prioritise creativity or work, in inverted commas, because let's face it, it's not all creative stuff that I am allowed to do. Just having the catalogue and all the stuff I've done, the touring, the records coming out, there's so much more involved. Than just getting down here and writing songs. I love to do that. But again, that's a mindset, and I like to have some open space in front of me. So over the years, I've become very good at compartmentalising. So when the tour was cancelled, I've been a bit obsessed with coronavirus from earlier in the year. So I was a very early warning siren for the whole thing. I was checking our insurance policy at the end of January, beginning of February, for the tour.
Oh, really?
Because, yeah, I just had a bad feeling. I thought the cat's out of the bag here. And you could tell as that sort of truth began to emerge about how contagious it was. I thought, how are they going to put it back in the bottle? I mean, you know, anyway. So, yes, I think I've really enjoyed this year. It's and that sounds, I don't want that to sound disingenuous, because obviously there have been downsides and it's been maddening and testing as well and very restrictive. But, you know, I've accepted those restrictions, and I think it's exposed a truth about British people too, that we're good with rules, but we're not very good with guidelines.
Mm.
So I think that, you know, when we're told to do something because for the general good, we bloody do it. Mm. And I was really impressed by my mates, who are a kind of arty crowd of, you know, musos and creative type people, lots of them anyway. They're complete head cases, half of them. But everybody took the whole thing very seriously at the beginning. You know, the distancing, the masks, the respect for others, the respect for the health service, everybody got it. And I think when it was put out in that very clear way, we all dealt with it well. It's been a bit of a shambles going forward.
Mm.
But, you know, without dragging the entrails of all the decisions out into the open,
sure.
You know, now we've got the vaccination program, and clearly we've stolen a march on lots of people with that, without getting into the moral ins and outs of that as well. It's changing people's mindset, and I can feel the positivity and the anticipation that I might be able to do some of the things that I didn't realise how much I was going to miss,
yeah.
You know, being able to perform. I'm always complaining because I've done so many shows and so much touring. I've probably taken it a bit too far,
yeah.
Certainly in terms of my family. So this has been a rare opportunity to spend some quality time with my kids and my wife and myself. So and I've really, really enjoyed it.
Lovely, lovely stuff. Right, David, I'm going to start a playlist.
Yeah.
Track one. I'm going to ask you to tell me the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
Well, I feel that I've chosen two things because it was a difficult track to pick. It's a kind of technical question, almost like a pub quiz question. And, you know, things like Party Fears 2 by The Associates.
Great. Yeah.
You know, came straight into my mind, just something where the riff is just like, whoa, yeah, from the word go, and it's like, and then when the song comes, there's not a single beat of the song that lets you down. It's
yeah.
just exquisite from start to finish. So something like that reminds me of being young as well, that has this power when it comes on. But the two tracks I singled out are La Ritournelle by Sébastien Tellier, which is... It's stretching the idea of an intro, but basically it's a repetitive piano riff with a drum groove that goes round and round for about 4 minutes before the vocal comes in. But it does build. So it, technically speaking, he's introing the 45 seconds of singing that he wants to do.
And that's... He's just introing the 45 second outro.
Exactly. Yeah. So I do think that's a wonderful piece of music. And I think that, aside from whether it's technically an intro or that the song is sort of the outro of the whole piece of music, it breaks down the barriers of what songwriting is. And that's what I love about that piece of music. When he came in with the voice, when I first heard that track, I was really surprised because it's so mesmeric anyway.
Yeah.
You don't need the singing to come in. So I think that's a classic track that shows you, hey, be patient, build this, let the sense of anticipation rise in the way, how would Massive Attack do this?
Yeah.
Let's drip feed the good stuff in there and get it better and better, and then take it to the next level.
Yeah.
So it's an absolute killer track. Now, the moment I'd written that down and suggested that was going to be my intro, I thought of one that's even more preposterous in a way, which is the longest fade-in that I know about. It's The Bad Plus,
yes.
And a track called Everywhere You Turn. It's absolutely phenomenal track, which slayed me whenever this came out about 15, 20 years ago.
Mm.
Great band as well. And it's got this, yeah, Chad Blake produced the first album, so it's all very beautifully recorded. And they just play this game on Everywhere You Turn, which has this phenomenal piano melody, almost like Keith Jarrett-esque. And... but it slowly, slowly faded. And I don't mean over a minute. It's like about 2.5 minute fading. And then the song's at full volume for another two and a half minutes. But it really, really works. And It's a trick I've never heard before. So, I've cheated. I've given you three answers to the question, but it was an interesting question that I've never been asked before.
Oh, good. It's always the one that musicians struggle with as well. It's always the one where they're like, yeah, I wanted to have that, but like, I'm just going to squeeze this answer in as well. But you've chose two songs that have very long and layered intros. Very much the case with the Telia track. So I just wonder, because I'm always interested in how songwriters approach songs, especially intros as well, that at the time, if we go back to, you know, when you first sort of touched like a big commercial success, like David Gray become thrown into like the pop mainstream.
Yeah.
And so I just wonder, like, was there ever and is there ever any pressure on you when you see the way that songs are being written now? I guess more towards mainstream pop music, but they will appear to be getting shorter, and the intro songs are now starting with choruses, and there's no fat on the bone in the word pop anymore. And I think a lot of that comes down to the way that people are listening to music now, totally. Which was like very different. I watch my kids' thumbs on their phones, and it's right. quick.
It's attention span is shrinking, so yeah. So my kids will listen to a track that is short, as you say. There's no fat on it whatsoever. By the time they've heard the chorus twice, they'll change it to another track.
Yeah.
You know?
So does that find its way into your mindset when you're approaching writing a new record?
No, because, you know, I'm sort of marooned in a distant past where that sort of taking your time and, you know, I guess it's partly the technology that was enabling when I was growing up, was allowing, well, basically became indulgent. So it's interesting that it's become less indulgent because, you know, CDs allowed you to stretch out even further. Your album could be an hour and 15 minutes. It's, you know, it got longer rather than what you can put on a piece of vinyl. Suddenly the game changed and you'd have Sledgehammer and massive singles like this that go on for about 5-6 minutes. It's, you know, so it's sort of, I think when that evolution happened, a lot of people took full advantage of their 5 minutes, but actually when you listen back to some of the longer tracks, they are a bit fluffy. And I think the part of me that when I got success, one of the things that came with it was dealing with making single cuts of our album tracks, because we made the album for so little money, we didn't even have real drums on it. So, you know, trying to put the thing out as a single, it wasn't like just whoring the thing. We thought we'd try and beef the thing up a bit by going into a real studio, putting real drums down, real pianos, see if we could give the thing a bit more muscle tone, because you know that on radio you need it. And, you know, we had the album, that was a fact. So it was a really interesting period, that White Ladder period of working into things. And it became, like, ridiculous in a way, because Babylon, we did two single mixes, one for ourselves, and then once Warner's got involved, a main one for them here. They got another couple of mixes done. In America, every time we stepped through the different radio formats, they wanted a new mix.
That's crazy, isn't it?
And it's just the egos getting involved.
Yeah.
Both at radio. Yeah, we love this, but it could do with a bit more. What, you know, hey, we're going to get such and such to sprinkle his magic dust on this. That'll be perfect. And then it's just like bullshit.
Yeah.
I remember one mix came back and it was like a conference call. It was excruciating. But they'd remixed Babylon, but they hadn't understood how all the MIDI parts were supposed, and they'd gone out of sync, basically, with the song. So this was like quite a big name mixer.
Yeah.
And I had the record company. What I didn't know was the guy who'd mixed it was also on the call. And
this don't bode well.
They said, hey, Dave, yeah, great, you got the mix. I said, yeah, I got the CDs. I said, it's a complete load of fucking bollocks. Whoever did this is a fucking idiot. The samples have gone out of sync with the fucking drums. I mean, what the fuck? And it was like, there was just fucking tumbleweed silence. I think they've been dining out on this story over there for years. So that's why your manager should always take the call and they should tell you afterwards. But he was on holiday at the time. So, yeah, anyway, so just in terms of, does it affect the way I work now? No, it doesn't, because I think actually I feel like life's too short and my interest is more and more rarefied. I'm more and more fascinated by, you know, Nina Simone at live at Montreux in 1976, or, you know, the things that I can't explain, the music that's beyond. Yeah. Tim Buckley's, you know, Earth is Broken, Astral Weeks, you know, Nebraska by Springsteen, records that will be aching and for all time. No one will ever work out quite what happened there. That's the stuff that obsesses me. It's how to get more poetic worth into the song. But sometimes it's interesting, you know, even now, you know, I have to adapt things for radio. And I listen back to some of the full-length mixes. Or live, you might cut the intro down a little bit because you sense the crowd want you to. And so you adapt, you change the song around. And I actually think, yeah, it works better like this. So sometimes it's not a bad thing to be efficient and brutal about what's important. And it's music's been boiled down to something like the gist, essentially, of the element. So the power of the hook and followed by another hook and then the slowdown and the emptying out and then the big... And then it's just a kick drum coming back in, but it feels absolutely euphoric. And, I mean, they're amazing. My kids play music, but the Rihanna tracks, the classic tracks, the one with Drake, you know, What's My Name and all that. I mean, they're absolutely phenomenal bits of music. Mm. And I'm fascinated by, you know, what's going on. I'm not going to stop rapping or anything. My kids say, why don't you, Dad? Come on.
Okay. Right. Well, David, I'm going to take you back for track two, and I'm going to ask you for the first song that you ever remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please.
Well, I've chosen a piece of choral music. My mum used to sing in the choirs, and she'd play the music at home that she liked to listen to, which was sometimes the stuff that she was doing in the choir, and other times, I guess, just for a listening pleasure. But I remember hearing this particular piece of music. And it wasn't until I was in my 30s that someone played me Allegri's Miserere. And I said, Jesus Christ, I know this thing. They played me a really great recording of it, which I can find out what it was. There are better recordings than others. It is just something holy. And that strange, haunting, you know, John Taverner-type choral music that has almost like rubbing harmonies where things are slightly ambiguous and the way that vocal arrangements were made way, way back. And this is the piece of music, famously, that Mozart transposed when he got back and he wrote it all out as a child. He heard it in church and it was banned. You weren't allowed to write this music down. It was considered too sacred. So you weren't allowed to write the notes of the music down, and what he did was actually a crime. So he went home, having heard it once in the church, and wrote the whole thing out. But it's when the very high descant hits the high note and hangs the thing down and it descends, it does bring tears to my eyes and, you know, reminds me of tracks where boys' voices are used, like famously on Spirit of Eden, you know, I Believe in You, where I mean, that makes me cry, that song. I don't know what it is. Is it a grief song? It plugs into somewhere deep in me that makes me grieve.
Yeah.
But that airy magic that you get only with that kind of voice. And this my mum playing choral music. You asked about what had an emotional impact. I remember being sort of stuck in my tracks listening to some of this music. And this is just one piece, but it's one of the only ones I could name, Chet.
And what was the emotion?
That I was in the presence of something other and sacred. So the emotion, I think, of what was in the music, none of this would have been understood by me as a small person, but it stopped me in my tracks. That's what I remember. I remember asking, what is this? You know, what is this? I mean, at the same time, my dad would be playing pop music, the Beatles, Elton John, you know, tracks like that I can remember. I thought of putting, like, Rod Stewart's, I Don't Want to Talk About It, songs that I remember hearing and being really fascinated by, and I Am Sailing, that Atlantic Crossing record. It's got sort of epic kind of emotion about it that I think you like sort of over-the-top stuff when you're a kid. Yeah. So, you know, this touching the hem of something just other, I mean, I think... You know, choral music, I mean, just to go back to my latest record, singing together with other people is sort of the ultimate form of music making, because to be joined by breath and use the voice, the physical aspect, and carrying the words and the idea together with nothing else, no drums, no nothing, the rhythm, everything, the melody, the chords, the structure, the muscle tone of that whole piece rests on you, really. It's a phenomenal feeling. So it's something I guess I've plugged into a bit on this latest thing. Rather than doing harmonies myself, which I do love to do, it's one of the great pleasures of recording, is finding close harmonies and interesting harmonies that are very intuitive to each singer. They'll hear things differently. But to have others come in and do their thing, it's been a gift beyond price.
Wonderful. I'm going to stay in the formative years for track three, David, and ask you for the song that reminds you of your time at school, please.
Well, I mean, this could have been like a gazillion things, but I've chosen "Come On, Eileen" because I don't name check Dexys enough. And much as I love Gino and the first album, which is, and now I probably prefer a little in a way to the second one. Mm-hmm. It was the second one that knocked my socks off first, because I don't know, it's just, I was working as a washer-upper in a restaurant in the summer holidays and the holidays. And when I went in, I could listen to the radio because I was first in. I had to make the salads and I had to do all that stuff. I had use of the sound system until everyone got in there for their shift and the evening thing. And I'd listen to the chart rundown. And it just reminds me of that summer. And then going to I lived in the middle of nowhere in Wales. So sort of barn dances and, you know, very rustic form of sort of dancing and rustic clubbing. Generally with a roasted animal nearby.
I'm sure there was an album called Rustic Clubbing in the late 90s. I guarantee it, mate.
Yeah, all dressed in Hessian. Like the Beloved or something. We've gone rustic. We've joined with the Wurzels.
Oh, amazing.
It's like Combine Harvester meets Euphoria, mate. It'll give you fucking A fever, it will. So I just remember this summer. I could have chosen, as I say, so many tracks, because I think at that time in your life, music is just something that's just, it's bits of your personality you're listening to that are adding into you. You're sort of constructing yourself out of all these postures and things and ideas. And, you know, I didn't start dressing like Dexys, but, you know, but this I actually preferred probably most of the songs on the whole Touré album more than I preferred the single. But the single just got played everywhere. And because they kind of, I was into like the Specials of Madness and when I was, you know, like 12, 13, 14. And then that waned and Dexys were still going. To get people to play that kind of music was difficult in the discos and the what have you. So, but that this track just got played to death, and I can remember dancing to it, really drunk. I mean, inappropriately young, no doubt at this stage. But a few times, and kissing girls, and it has this. I lived in this small fishing village, and it's like a tourist place, really. So in the summer, you know, you'd meet girls and that you had more options, essentially. So, yes, a carefree time in my life that's why I've chosen this. This is a summer number one that I remember just that summer, whatever summer that was, 1983, I guess, maybe, or 84, probably 83. Frankie was 84, wasn't it?
Yeah, I reckon 83, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's so weird because, you know, I feel that, like, Dexys do get their credibility now. I do think people have acknowledged now that Dexys, you know, are a really important band. But it always feels that that's the kind of novelty record. It gets sort of dismissed because of wedding discos for the last, you know, 30-odd years. But it's one of them songs. I was literally sitting where I'm sitting now with my mate a couple of weeks ago recording, and it came on the radio, and we sat there, and I just went, do you know what, like, I haven't sort of stopped and listened to this record properly.
No.
Ever. It's just one of them songs that's always there. And then when you listen to it, it's like, fucking hell, this is a masterpiece. It is just, there's nothing missing from that record. Oh,
it's brilliant as well. I think the daring to conceive of such a song, I mean, it's so instant that you immediately think, oh, yeah, it's like, this is just pop.
Yeah.
But it's actually banjos and stuff. I mean, it's like, you know, but that record, double tracking as well, it's much more produced than the first album. So I think that perhaps took a little bit of the sort of credibility sheen off.
Maybe,
You know, listening to it as someone who's made records now, I can, oh, God, yeah, they've doubled this and they've doubled that. It's really very produced. But but just great energy, great high concept. It's like, well, you don't quite know where his head's at, where is he coming from. It's like a sort of weird stream of consciousness of all this stuff with this sort of smutty love song going on in the middle of it. But as you say, the construction of the thing, the slowdown, come up. I mean, to pull all that off.
Yeah.
I'm like, was this done to a click or is this done live?
Yeah.
And I bet it's a bit of both. Yeah. You know, and I've done exactly the same thing as you're describing. It's later in life. You can't really hear that song because it just got played to death, but actually it's brilliant.
Yeah.
And the whole thing, poor old Johnny Ray. I mean, who the fuck's Johnny Ray anyway?
Yeah. So
that's how it starts. It's,
yeah.
And just where he's going with the lyric. And it's brilliant. And the whole album, I think, is fantastic. So melodic, so energised. Whatever he was on at that time, whether he regrets the fact it was a little poppier than, you know, the first one or whatever, because maybe he got a little bit of flack or it became so popular. I actually think that, a bit like the Waterboys, This Is the Sea, comparable, where very produced record, but actually brilliant because the songs and the sentiment, he's still gritty, he's still believable. He pulls it all together. So, anyway, I bought into it as a 15-year-old or whatever, enormously. I remember getting that record back, same thing, going down to the restaurant and being able to listen to the cassette all the way through before anyone else got there. And this is fucking brilliant. I had to do like an hour and a half's bus journey to be able to go and buy it because that was the nearest record shop.
Listen up. I've only got another new sponsor. Egg Fried. It's this super cool clothing label. And if you're into sort of skating and street art and gigging and kind of like really cool art and throwing a little bit of Asian culture and the designer's kind of weird sense of humour in the mix, then you're pretty much there with the wonderful world that is eggfried.com. Now, they do these amazing punchy kind of graphic tees, hoodies and sweatshirts, beautiful art prints, as well as this. They have a denim range, all handmade in-house, all supporting the slow fashion movement. Not only that, they've given you a discount code, 10% off when you head over to eggfried.com. Just use the code EGGSALAD, EGGSALAD, save 10%. Go and get lost in the world of Egg Fried. Also, they've got a new kids range, and it's called Small Fried, and it's super cool, super cute. And again, it's all over there in this wonderful world. Go and get involved at eggfried.com. How was school for you?
Well, it was very good. You know, I was in Manchester, so my early years were in Manchester, and we were in a kind of, we moved out of Sale to Hale, which is a big change, one letter, but very different world. And then I think my parents took me out of peer group pressure. They took me out of the local primary school, and I went into, because I was bright, I got put into like a prep school, which streamed for Manchester Grammar. So that was the way I was going. And it was brutally sort of streamed as well at the prep school. Like, you sat in desks, I remember, depending on your test results, that's how close to the front you were. So it was like utterly right off. I went from that reality. I was very academic, as well as being very into art and stuff. And then went to Wales, where I was already about a year and a half ahead of the class I was supposed to be in. But it was like landing in this tiny little local school in Wales. It was just the most lovely thing, the warmest welcome, and idyll, really, a sort of childhood idyll of just no real pressure. There was a decent comprehensive school a few miles away, which we all went to for, once we went to the big school. So that was my reality, and it was lovely. You know, it was a small village community, and you knew everybody, and it was really lovely. Then at secondary school, I lost interest in my studies about the same time I gathered my interest in, you know, all the things you're not supposed to do, like drinking, smoking, chasing girls, and obviously listening to music. I didn't have any older brothers and sisters, so it wasn't until I got to secondary school that really kicked in, but it kicked in very quickly. And then after a couple of years, I guess I was hanging around with some of the less academic kids who were a bit more mental and a bit more up for whatever, so, or more into music, which was probably more important, you know. So I wanted to dress differently, and, you know, I used to get beaten up because I'd dress, you know, in weird ways, like either like Madness, or a bit later on I'd wear a bit of Robert Smith Lippy or something. Someone would want to kick the shit out of me for that. So it was that was what school was like, and it was, again, it was a really fun experience. My parents were probably thinking, what the hell happened? Because my grades and everything just disintegrated when I was about 13. But with art and English, the things I was really interested in, I kept on, you know, being interested. I didn't do much work with English, but so that was sort of, I just took the path of least resistance from there. I went to art school and, you know, I worked it out. I scanned the scene. Art school, that's the way to go. No, I loved painting. I loved, so that was, it was a very happy time for me. I was very untroubled. After I left school, my parents got divorced, but I didn't really see that coming. So at that period of my life, I was just, I'm down there. This is a different era, you know. I'd walk miles to see friends or cycle miles. And I was just out all the time.
Yeah.
I was out all the time, you know, doing things, smoking, drinking, kissing girls, whatever. I was just out all the time. And you were free to be out. Doors were left open. It was a small community in the middle of nowhere. That's what my school years were like, you know, very, very dreamy.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Really?
And I mean, I've seen you on stage, you know, I've been in crowds of big crowds watching you on stage, and you always seem, from where I'm standing, you seem to be very comfortable and confident in what you're doing. Was you a confident young man?
I think that, everybody's a complicated bag of different contradictory elements. So I'd say that I was very shy in some ways, but I've always had an inner confidence ever since I was little. And I don't know where that came from. I don't think it's something you can give to someone. I think it was just innate.
Yeah.
And so I can remember my first time on stage, like proper time. I was at Solva School. As I say, I moved there, so I was 8 or 9 years old. And the Christmas play was on and I was just one of the sort of extras in the play, but they'd worked out that I had a good memory. And the main character in the school play, got sick the day before the show. So I had one day to learn the play. They brought me in as his understudy. And I learnt the lines, no problem. But he had dance moves. They were like, they didn't have a chance to go through the choreography with me. So when it came to doing the wizard's dancing, I just had to improvise in a wizardy way.
And glorious.
I was a huge hit with this very small audience of probably only about 40 or 50 people. But I remember the adulation that I remember them giving it up for me. Mm. And, you know, some people step up on the stage under the lights and they get a feeling of terror. But for me, it just worked the other way. I saw how the electric current passed through me, you know, the loop. I saw the loop working and realised there was nothing to worry about. This was actually wonderful. And there, a penny dropped somewhere and I began to do... I didn't do a huge amount of Amdram and stuff like that, but I did a bit. I liked being on the stage. And then I formed a band and made an exhibition of myself, basically, just, you know... So that's what I was. I was full of ideas, and yeah, full of confidence. I guess bordering on arrogance when you're a teenager because you're just an idiot. You say, "Oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be on." I remember the headmaster taking the piss out of the school band because we were allowed to play at the disco, and basically everybody left, and we were called we were called the Vacuums, and he said, "Everyone who went to the disco last night." I think we all saw something rather important, the first concert of the Vacuums. I guess we'll be seeing them all on Top of the Pops very soon. And the whole place went into an uproar. And I just thought, right, OK, mate, you've taken it too far there. You know, at least we're doing something. Fuck your homework.
Oh, I hope you knocked on his door when you went on Top of the Pops.
People don't have Top of the Pops anymore. It's sad.
Well, it's a question that I always like to ask musicians, because as someone that grew up obsessed with that TV show, and you mentioned Madness and you mentioned the specials and obviously Associates and stuff, and at that point seeing Top of the Pops was just so exciting because everybody, Adam and they all looked so brilliant. Everybody looked so brilliant. Then Madness started making music videos, and it was like the ultimate thing for young lads to just get obsessed with, seeing these Herberts from like North London. Just totally, like, yeah. It just seemed like the best thing. So I've actually spoke to like a couple of the guys from Madness on here about them first kind of ventures onto Top of the Pops, because at that point you think you do Top of the Pops and then you get on a Concorde and fly home, and you know, just to count your money. But you know, they walked home, and so I just wondered, like, for you, David, like, obviously I presume you grew up watching Top of the Pops like everybody else. Like, how was it for you when you got the call saying you was going to go on Top of the Pops, and did it deliver?
It was part of the most exciting week of my life. So the story of White Ladder has been well told, but needless to say, it was a slow journey from release in Ireland to release in the UK and then being picked up by Warners over a year after the original release. Then they started to put some weight behind the whole thing. And we gathered, so by the time of Glastonbury, in the summer of 2000, we were, you know, the record was creeping up into the top 10, top 5, the album. And Babylon was being re-released as a single. So we played on the other stage, what was the NME stage. And then came back, we had a party, got back to the hotel, and my manager said, yeah, we just had a call. Burt Bacharach's pulled out tomorrow. Everyone loved your performance today. They've asked, can we stay on an extra day and play on the main stage tomorrow? So I said, wow, okay, yeah. And we all kind of looked at each other, and it was like things in Ireland were that much bigger. So we were starting to headline festivals over there. But that was mind blowing. I mean, yeah. It was like the Battle of Helm's Deep. People were like, you know, seas of people. They weren't orcs, but I mean. and so we were there. There we were. So suddenly we were going on three slots before David Bowie on the closing slot of. Yeah, on the main stage at Glastonbury, the sun starting to go down, and
Perfect.
Well, we were super nervous, but we just had the best time. And then when we got backstage, we were so blown away. So things, mad stuff happened. My dad turned up. He was having chemotherapy. He just pulled the things out of his arm. We got his mate to pick him up. He couldn't stand missing the whole thing. So he came down from Wales. He managed to blag into the backstage behind the main stage. People came out of the woodwork. There was a whole, we had a party, you know. We were smoking and drinking everything we had. We were completely bongoed. And then my dad said, look at David Bowie standing over there. He doesn't know what to do with himself. Tell you what, I'm going to go and talk to him. So this is a long story. I do apologise. But this is all leading up Top of the Pops. So I said, no way, Dad. Listen, you blagged in here. That's one thing. You're not going to just go and kick through his security cordon and go and have a chat with Bowie. I said, leave the guy alone. Come on, though. Well, he knew he was going to die, like my dad, you know, in the near to mid future. So he didn't give a shit. He just said, no, I'm going. So Tim, the keyboard player, said, Pete, I'm coming with you. So me and Clune said, OK, we're in. And he had this charm, my dad. He charmed us in there. And then we had a chat with Dave. He was super charming. And he was absolutely right. He'd nailed it. He was having a funny moment, basically thinking, yeah, you know, I've had a funny old period of time leading up to this gig. And that was his sort of beginning of his reclamation, really, that performance. And he really, anyway, it got to the point where we were chatting to him for like an hour. And he was like, really enjoying talking to us. We had the buzz, you know, it was all happening. He knew what that was like. He'd done it. And he showed me a set list. It was just ridiculous, like Wild as the Wind, Starman, Ashes to Ashes. He said, do you think it'll be all right? I said, Jesus Christ, baby.
No, I'll drop that one.
Yeah, I'll lose Starman. Everyone's forgotten that. Ashes to Ashes, that's a bit crap as well. It was, anyway, then someone from the record company said, well, now it's the chart rundown. And I'd completely forgotten that we even had a single in the chart. And then it went all the way down. By the time we got into the top 10 and they hadn't said Babylon, I thought, well, we've not made it into the top 40. And then it went in at number 5. So then, you know, that we went on to sort of, we were already on cloud 9. We went on to cloud 10. And then we all had to get onto the tour bus because someone said, well, we've got to get back. We were Top of the Pops on Tuesday night. And this was Sunday night. And it was like, what? So the whole thing was just completely mad. And then you're there and you've got the logo behind you. And it was just... And then, you know, I don't really remember much about the Top of the Pops performance or anything. I just remember the logo and someone snapped a photo of us. And, you know, there was Albert Square or whatever was out there. Yeah. You could go and sit on what's-his-name's bench, you know. So we did all that kind of kerfuffle. And then basically did our performance. And then I think it used to air on a Friday night at that time. And then we had a big party on the Friday with everyone round to mine to watch Top of the Pops.
I mean, it was, as far as weeks go, that ain't bad, is it?
I was so far out into the stratosphere. I think what it is like we all have to hold our sort of defensive coating because the world is not an easy place.
Yeah.
And people can wound you, you know, and especially us old musos who've been putting it out for God knows how long and, you know, been pissed on, shit on and ignored. It's like we're all carrying these kind of shadows with us. There was something happened that week that was so euphoric and so total. We just felt the love to the extent. We just let all the armour just fell to the ground. And it was like, whoa, this is it. We love it. It's like life's fucking brilliant. And we just, I laughed so much. I was just, without even booze or anything, I was just high as a kite. Yeah. And I remember that feeling. It lasted like weeks, you know. I couldn't come back down. And, of course, you've got the whole trajectory then. We were just like, it started kicking off everywhere. And it all becomes a bit of a blur because there's only so much champagne and, you know, business class fucking air travel you can do.
Sure. Oh, how lovely. What a week. Well, you touched on getting the bus into to the record shop earlier. So for track 4, I'm going to ask you, going to stay in the formative years for this one. The first record you remember buying from a record store, please, David.
Yeah, it was from Woolworths in Haverford West. It was I Don't Like Mondays by the Boomtown Rats. So I guess I was 11 when this came out. And like I said, I'd just gone to secondary school. And I remember seeing it on Top of the Pops and thinking it was a very instant, very theatrical kind of song. So I was straight into town and I bought it. And then I made a friend because I sort of took it into school to show the person sitting next to me. And someone else said, oh, yeah, right, yeah, that's a good track, you know. And then that we became school friends from that point on, David George.
It's really weird. I saw a documentary on the iPlayer about 3 weeks ago about the Boomtown Rats. And my knowledge of them doesn't go far beyond, I don't know, Mondays and Rat Trap, I think.
Yeah.
And most of the stuff I heard, I wasn't particularly fond of. But they didn't sound like anyone else. They were quite a unique sounding band. It had a bit of pub rock, but it was a bit post-punk and a bit punk. It was like a hybrid.
I think it was Americanized.
Yeah.
So those kind of American kind of rock, what was not quite punk.
Yeah.
Like a pubbier kind of American-y kind of thing. So like, I'm trying to think, they're not bands I really know much about, so I'm not going to be able to name check them all. But there's a certain American sound, which like cooler American bands that they were sort of, I guess, influenced by, or even like Tom Petty and stuff.
Yeah, and the Cars and things like that.
You can see that. So it wasn't in any way cool, I don't think, compared. But they did write a couple of great singles, Rat Trap and... Rat Trap, when you listen to that, is like a quite pubby kind of, quite overly complex kind of thing. It was that... They styled in a punky way, but they really weren't a part of that. It was something a bit different and... You know, but he was very charismatic, wasn't he? And I think when you were a kid, like 11, I was very taken in by the bullhorn crackles and the captain. Yeah. The bullhorn crackles and the captain tackles all the problems in the house and ways. And you could see no reason. And it was like, yeah, I like this. I'm going to go and buy it. So that's the first single I bought.
Oh, if someone would have told me a couple of weeks ago David Gray's going to be singing Boomtown Rats It to me, I'd never have believed you. As you've got older, through your late teens and early 20s and stuff like that, how important were for you with your back combed hair and your Robert Smith lippy on, how important were like record shops for you growing up?
Yeah, they were vital. I mean, there weren't many to go to for me. So I've had a strange... My way of discovering music is more word of mouth than always has been. Apart from what I'd see on Top of the Pops. Oh, there's Echo and the Bunnymen. I like that. I'm going to go and buy it. Ocean Rain or whatever. It was like people would tell me, have you heard the Cramps? Have you heard this? Have you heard the Meteors? Or if you like the Cramps, you like the Meteors. You might should check this out. Have you heard the Cocteau Twins' first album? And I'd have to ring up the record shop, Swales in Hereford West, and order anything that wasn't in the charts. And then, you know, they'd say that'll be in next week. And then I'd go into town on the Saturday on the bus and pick it up with my pocket money. And I'd like not eat my dinner. I'd save my dinner money. So I'd like starve myself at school so I could buy another, you know, single or something. And I'd go into town and buy it. So, yeah, there's all that excitement, which isn't there anymore, obviously.
But there's so much to be got from that journey, isn't there?
Well, you'd read the entire liner notes before you could listen to the damn thing. You'd have read it cover to cover and like looked at the weird images and the photos. I remember buying Madness, I must have been 11 at the time, One Step Beyond album, and all the photos on it, which still fascinate me now.
Pictures of their mates and stuff like that. It was like, who are they?
It was the scene. It was the scene, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them didn't look that sort of skinhead or that mod.
Yeah.
They just looked like London people, you know, in a photo booth, most of them. So, pouring over those things. So, but, you know, where I lived was right at the bottom of a valley. So there was no radio reception. So I'd never listened to John Peel, for example, or any of those things. I couldn't get that. And so I was finding out from older people and other people, if I like this, if I like Bob Dylan, have I ever heard John Martin? If you like John Martin, have you heard Nick Drake? If you like Bob Dylan, have you heard Leonard Cohen? And it was all through my life. I mean, I've never been that hip kid who just knows it all because his parents did. or his elder brothers and sisters. I've always just been slowly piecing it together. And, sure. You know, so it was a long time before I discovered Van Morrison, for example, who's a real, obviously a massive effect on me when I did discover him. Mm. But I was probably about 20 years old by the time I heard him, you know. So it was, so record shops, I'm not one of those people who goes browsing in record shops now. I'm afraid sort of, you know, I'm on the streaming thing. Mm-hmm. I listen to things like Late Junction now to find nuggets, and then I'll explore outwards if I find a band or a track that I really, really love. I'll even let the algorithm suggest other things sometimes. Yeah. I'm generally quite resistant, though. I'm sort of hair shirt wearing. I'd rather not be enjoying myself than be told how to enjoy myself by things that apparently know what I enjoy. I'm not complying on any level with this authoritarian pleasure fucking principle.
But I'm not going down a record shop, though, because that's too much of a pain in the arse. Well,
they've all been shut, haven't they? It was so funny, because I get my hair cut in Soho and I go down Berwick Street and see all the, you know, and sadly some of them have gone. I do love to see them.
Yeah.
You know, and see things in the window that I haven't heard. And I mean, if I ever write a memoir or a book, it's going to be, I'm going to be using certain albums to trigger memories.
Yeah.
You know, ones that I haven't listened to. I'm keeping a few in reserve that I haven't listened to in, you know, 30 years odd. So I guess the record shops were absolutely vital to me growing up. Absolutely vital, essential. I poured all my money, and there was also a small guitar shop there. I bought my first electric guitar in the same shop. So it was a vital place to go. And then listening to what they would say, there was a stall as well in the market where he'd sell records, and he'd say, oh, if you like Bob Dylan, you might like John Cooper Clarke. So that's how I discovered John Cooper Clarke, and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I'm going to take you forward a little bit now, to track five, where I'm going to ask you the song that soundtracked your year's clubbing, please, David.
Well, I mean, I didn't really have any years clubbing. I was sort of, you know, a lunatic doing whatever in my late teens and 20s. But I've never liked places where you can't hear what anyone's saying to you. And I think that kind of doff, doff, doff music just wasn't spatial enough for me. I did when I came to London, and I, with my manager, Rob Holden, he was always also managing Orbital.
Right.
I married Olivia, and Rachel, Olivia's sister, was married to Phil from Orbital. So it was a very complex. And when I came down and met them, I started to go into Orbital gigs, and then things like Tribal Gathering and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, you do what everyone else is doing. You take a pill and you have a bloody fucking great time.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to pick an Orbital track for that period. I do remember a wonderful gig. My favourite Orbital record is the Brown record,
Yeah. Second
one. Impact, Earth is Burning is my favourite track on there. So I remember watching them doing like a sort of all-nighter at Brixton Academy, like Club Dog, Mega Dog it was called.
Yeah.
And probably about 94.
Yeah.
Like Christmas, New Year, 94 sort of thing. So it was like, and that was like, I do think they had something special. They wanted to be like Kraftwerk, that had that little bit of performance and playing and authenticity and complexity to their electronic music. They weren't happy just bish, bash, bosh. It was, you know, Paul and Phil have got, you know, really Catholic taste in music, but also, you know, they're as interested in Philip Glass as they are in,
yeah,
you know, all this other stuff that, you know, that everyone was feeding off. So there's a real complexity. And one thing I remember about being in the crowd was the way that they would bring the crowd up and then chill. And I feel that dynamics, basically, which that was one of the things I didn't like about a lot of electronic music.
Yeah.
There's the sort of boom, boom, just the relentless. It's like mechanized, isn't it? It's like sort of, you know, it's just sort of industrial kind of. I mean, I'm not going to slag it because, you know, Warm Leatherette or Blue Monday, where the only human thing on Blue Monday is Bernard's vocal and Hookie's guitar, everything else is programmed, is just a phenomenal piece of music and poetry that never dims.
Yeah.
And as intriguing as Pink Moon by Nick Drake still to this day. So I don't think that the click track is the enemy, but I think it's too easy to just, you know, the less musical can achieve a result. And again, I don't mind that. Sometimes the simplest, most bedroom means, something like somehow strange and hard to define comes out of it. So and this all played a part in White Ladder. I mean, we definitely bit into that bedroom sound and that electronic sound. But again, it's got to have dynamics and ebb and flow. I'm like, why are you taking me on this journey? There's got to be a point where this crescendos, and I go, fuck. You know, even if there's no words.
Well, I'm going to take you home for track six and ask for a favourite song from an artist from your home county, please, David.
Well, I'm going back to Manchester because technically I am a Mancunian, and obviously this gives me rich picking, so I could go for, you know, the first single on Factory, the Duritty Column, Sketch of Summer, which is a track I absolutely fucking love. But I'm not. I'm going to go for my mate, Brian Glancy. So the track's actually, if you go on Spotify, it will say Mark Burgess and the Sons of God. And they made a hit. But this was Mark Burgess and the Sons of God, was Mark Burgess and Brian Glancy. Brian was a very close friend of mine that I made from supporting Mark and Brian at a gig in Liverpool when I was still at art school and I was starting to gig with my band, Waiting for Defo. And I supported them at a small club in Liverpool and just really liked Brian. He's very quirky and very friendly and very out there. And I'd go over to Manchester and hang out with him from Liverpool. And we became fast friends. And for all my second album touring, Brian was, in inverted commas, my tour manager. So basically my mate, driving my Golf around with the guitars in the back around Europe. And then flying around America and driving around America together. So we had all kinds of adventures. Anyway, yeah, he was a wonderful singer-songwriter in his own right, and this is one of the best songs he ever wrote. It's called Beat the Boat, and it's on Zema Junction by Mark Burgess and the Sons of God. So it's a track that will bring a tear to my eye because, you know, Brian passed away in 2006, and so he's no longer with us. And that He was also a great mate of Guy Garvey's and Elbows, and that's the seldom seen kid is Brian. So, it's Beat the Boat and it's basically Mark Burgess and the Sons of God, but Brian Glancy singing. It's Brian.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Singing the song, Mark singing a bit of harmony on it.
I'd never heard it until I got your list over, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, right. It's so, Brian was like a bit dangerous, so like I've been on the rough side of the tracks, and there's just whenever he does a kind of soft confessional line or something, there's real peril there. That is, it's like he's venturing something. You know, he was a wonderful bloke. Yeah, absolutely fucking hilarious, like a stand-up comedian, really. So yeah, so this track, I should also, I guess, tell the anecdote of the reason I played "Say Hello, Wave Goodbye" on an acoustic guitar, is because Brian did it with Mark as like an encore at one of the gigs I saw them do in like 91, 92. And I remember hearing it thinking, fucking hell, that's brilliant. What a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
And a couple of years further on, I was asked to do a cover as part of an AIDS gig in Ireland, like a charity gig. And when I was prepping the gig, I just thought of that song and I thought, yeah, this is perfect on so many levels. So I learnt it off the CD and obviously gave it a little bit of a twist. And when I played that song for the first time myself in front of an audience, the Dublin crowd started singing it back. So by the time I got to the last chorus, it was like everybody singing. I thought, fucking hell, this has just got something. And then I kind of jammed out the end and it became this live staple that ended up being the last song on White Ladder. So Brian's to blame.
It's a beautiful song, and your cover of it is absolutely incredible as well, David. And I have this thing, if I'm a bit hungover and I've got that kind of like that little bit of sort of hungover anxiety, I like to kind of jump on YouTube and just watch some songs that I know are going to kind of get me a little bit emotional. And there's a version of Soft Cell's last ever show at the O2, and they finish obviously with Sail Away, Wave Goodbye. Oh my God, it's beautiful, and I can vividly remember one of the first ever kind of gigs I ever went to with my now my wife was. I don't live too far from Chelmsford, and I saw you at V in maybe 2001.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know her that well then. And I remember when you played that, I had to pop my sunglasses on because I was welling up. I was like, I can't be crying in front of this girl yet. it's too soon. So, yeah, it's that song does something, and I absolutely adore your cover of it, mate.
Oh, thanks.
Well, for the last song, this is when you get to play DJ and Tastemaker, and I'm going to ask you, David, for a song that many people may not know that you would like them to hear, please.
Well, I guarantee that it's a song most people won't know. I've just discovered it through Late Junction. So it's the band, they're called Deep Listening Band. Pauline Oliveros is an accordion player, but also like a musical adventurer. So the Late Junction episode that I heard it on was subterranean music. It was music with a subterranean theme. So this was cut in 1991, this track. And what it was the whole group of them got together, two voices, bass trombone, accordion. Sounds rather unpromising, I know. bear with me. Some found metal percussion and a didgeridoo player. So there's no electronics. There's no amplification. They heard that there was a cistern, a disused water cistern, under wherever they live, Washington State or Washington, D.C., I'm not sure which. And they found a way in and they tunneled down into this thing and it was built to hold like 200 million gallons of water. It was now empty, a concrete space. Well, your average cathedral has an 8 to 9 second reverb. This reverb in here was 45 seconds long. So they made an album called Ready Made Boomerang for obvious reasons. All the titles have got fantastic, fantastic titles. The track I'm choosing is CCCC. Which stands for Cistern Chapel Chance. And it's a bit of a listen now. So I'm going to reference you with 2001 A Space Oddity, the sort of Space Odyssey, the bit where he's sort of the trippy bit where he's going through time with turning into a baby and everything and all the music and the kind of choral stuff. And so something as ambitiously wide open as that, and Daniel Lanois and Brian Eno's Apollo record, which is one of my favourite Brian Eno records for sure, if not my favourite. So it's more out there than either of those, I would suggest. And this track is 18 minutes long. It's not for the faint-hearted, you will be seeing into the mind of God. So if you imagine an improvisation in a chamber, a dark chamber, where there's a 45-second reverb, if you hit one bum note, that's it. You've ruined it. And it's 45 seconds before it disappears. So they're playing these very sparse lines. So accordion doesn't sound like accordion. It sounds like a synth. So they said that they described that they were playing the reverb. The entire cistern was the instrument. and they were just activating notes in it. But when the voices come in and start holding, it's just, oh my God. I mean, yeah. It is have a smoke and just put their headphones on or sit down, turn the speakers up, make sure there's no one in the house. Every time I put it on, my wife says, "Can you turn that off, please?" You know. it's not for the faint-hearted, but I do think it's an extraordinary piece of music. And thank God there are people just willing to take such chances and push the outer limits of what is music and what's worth doing. Tunnelling, breaking an entry, tunnelling down into a massive disused cistern and somehow managing to record an entire album down there. Fair play to them. Anyway, it's the whole album is absolutely magnificent. So it's a new discovery for me. And with Skellig, my latest record, I think there's so much space in the record. Space was the most, you know, important element in a way. It had to have a drift, an unhurried, contemplative space for every idea and song. And then when I heard this record, I realised, sometimes when you get to sound check, you just plug in, same guitar, same U, same chords, but you're in this massive space, big empty room, PA is on, you hear it go, dong! And so it's actually a different instrument, because what you're getting is this resonance that's just going out up through the stage, through your feet. The bass player plays a note, and it's like, supercharged. The space you're in and the sound that your instrument makes changes your entire, the idea of what the music is you're making. And really, so many chance encounters with sound and with music lead to songs being born. So picking up a new guitar or a new instrument, it's the same chords, same notes, but they sound different. And so you might go C, F, G, but for whatever reason, it sounds great. And suddenly you've got a song without having to worry about what the chords are. I did that last time. So anyway, this is a remarkable thing. It's a proper listen. So dial into it.
Well, David, we put together a Spotify playlist to accompany the podcast so people can go and listen to all of the songs that you've picked and some of the other songs that we've chatted about today and some tracks from the new record as well. As we find ourselves, I mean, recording this on the 19th of April and we're on, as we touched upon at the beginning, hopefully, you know, the road out of this is going to be a positive and a fruitful one, and it's going to see us being able to reconnect with people and you know, and hug our friends and stuff again. So as this year is unfolding, what are you most looking forward to personally and what's going to be happening professionally?
I think the things I'm most looking forward to are, yes, being able to hug people. And I think we didn't realise that all the sort of gestural, behavioural stuff like handshakes, hugs, kisses on cheek seemed a bit sort of pointless and ritual. But actually, they're part of disarming this animal stutteriness, this wariness that actually lives inside us. We are basically animals that's quite sniffy and sort of lone wolfy.
Yeah.
And watching that behavior. So it would be nice to get together and really, you know, hang out and get drunk and not have to worry about anything and go to a nice restaurant and all the rest of it. We're hoping to do some gigs for the Skellig, just a couple of shows at Union Chapel. And maybe a couple in Dublin, but it's very, very hard to plan. It's every Tom, Dick and Harry's trying to book the different venues out. And it's very hard to get a straight answer about what's going to be possible. So I think we've got quite humble aspirations. The first aspiration regarding Skellig is to get together as a band in Ireland, looking onto the Skelligs and do a live streamed performance of the whole album.
Nice.
And that was supposed to be in May, but it looks more like June. And again, it's just the goalposts keep moving. So I think I'm in no big hurry. So the idea of doing that would be mind-boggling. I mean, without an audience, just to be able to sing together and know that everyone's going to be listening. I think we'll have tears flowing down our faces. The joy of that music making will be... you know, I used to say I'd like there to be a World Music Day where no one's allowed to play any music. And then at midnight, you get to hear either like Nina Simone or, you know, or Allegri's Miserere, perhaps. You know, you have a day off, not in lifts, not anywhere, shops. It's just there's no music allowed, no cars. It's basically nullified. World Music Day, so that you can actually hear what music is at the end of the day, because it gets used as a sort of filler and a sort of background and a wallpaper thing and a sexer-upper and a, you know, Sky Sports this and a this that and it bish bash bosh. Anyway, so that the idea of just playing together, I think, is going to be so profound. So those are my musical aspirations for the year. The White Ladder Tour has been put back till next year, so it's another year away. That gives me some creative space. I've started to write, so I'd hope that I'll have gathered real momentum during the summer and autumn, and I'll have written a whole batch of new stuff, which I'll have to then get to grips with at some point. It all depends when all these things actually happen or if they happen. So, yeah, this would be like December for the Skellig shows if they were going to happen. So, anyway, we'll just have to wait and see. I'm really going to have to go, Stu, because I've...
That's all good. So the one-stop shop for people to kind of find out what you are up to, the website or social media, where's the best place?
I guess Facebook and website. Is probably my Facebook page, my website. They'll have all the info about what's going on.
Lovely. David, I've had such a good time chatting to you today, mate. Thank you so much.
It's been fun. Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Right. Cheers.
Oh, that was great. So great. Like, I didn't want that one to finish. That was such a good chat and great song choices. And I loved, you know, how passionate David was when, you know, explaining to me choral music, I guess, and the acoustics and, you know, and that 45 second bounce back of reverb was just fascinating. And to get an insight into a week that involves two Glastonbury performances, you know, going on Top of the Pops, going top 10 or top 5. Wonderful. And yeah, just I'm still buzzing. I'm recording this intro straight after recording it. And I'm, still buzzing from that one. So I hope you get, a fraction of this joy that I'm experiencing right now from that chat. Because it was a cracker. Right. Also, thanks to Lou for facilitating this conversation. Thank you very much. That's much appreciated. Head over to Spotify and listen to David's playlist. It's on there now. Go and just search Off the Beaten Track guest playlists and you'll be able to access hundreds of them as well. And which are always quite interesting things to see when, it starts off with a great intro. And then by the time I ask for like the song that reminds you of school or your first emotional record, it can generally go straight to something like, I don't know, the Reynolds Girls. And so when you if you didn't know the podcast and you just flicked over to the guest playlist, you think, why the fucking hell has he chose that? But obviously, the key is to listen to the chat. Then you get the backstory, and that's the beauty of this podcast. Give us a subscribe or a like or a love or a share or a retweet or a message and let us know what episodes you've enjoyed, who you'd like to see me chat to or hear me chat to. If you want to see them, you can watch the videos of these episodes over on my Patreon, as well as getting access to radio shows. And there's probably 200-300 odd shows over there now that have never been released to the public. So you can go and access that and video episodes over there, and that's on patreon.com/offthebeatentrack. It's all on the website. Everything you need to know about archives and Patreons and merch and everything else, go to the website, which is www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. I'll see you next time. Thanks ever so much for listening. Bye-bye.
It's Off the Beat and Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.